So on December 24th, about 7:30 in the evening, I got a phone call. And whenever the phone rings at night, I know it's probably work and it's bad news, but it was my sergeant. And Sergeant Al Carter told me that there was a missing person in Modesto, and she was pregnant, and the officers on scene were wanting to have a detective come out and assist in their investigation. So I told him I'd go, and it was Christmas Eve, and we were having dinner with my kids and my wife, and I finished my dinner, and the sergeant on scene was Byron Deerfelt, and I called him from my house, told him I'd be on my way. He kind of gave me a little briefing, and I told him I was going to come straight there. It'd be about an hour and a half, but I asked him to not let anybody in the house, just kind of coordinate off, and when I got there, introduced me to the husband. So when I arrived at Covina, which was the unusual part, was there was a lot of people there in the driveway. I mean, there was, you know, thermoses of coffee. People were already putting up flyers. And I met with the sergeant and the officers, and they kind of briefed me. And then they introduced me to Scott. And I introduced myself to him, and I asked him to walk me through the house and kind of walk me through the day and tell me what he knew about when he last saw Lacey.
As a seasoned detective at this point, do you try to refrain from theorizing anything?
So I've been around the block a few times, and I was just thinking it was a missing person case. I mean, I could hear... on my way down, I could hear the helicopters over the radio when cops would talk. I heard they were in the park searching. So I knew they were searching. And when I met Scott, I've never met him before. He seemed like a nice guy, just there to do my job. Scott walked me through the house, showed me his house. He allowed me to search his cars, his truck and her car. I asked him if he would take me to where the boat was, his shop, and he agreed, and we went over to the shop. And then I asked him to come back to the police department for an interview. And all during this time, I'm telling Scott, there's cops and detectives searching, knocking on doors, interviewing people. But my primary job with you, Scott, is to eliminate you, or not eliminate you yet, but my job is to, I don't want to say eliminate, but eliminate you as any kind of a suspect. And so I have to ask you hard questions. And my experience tells me you're not going to like me very much by the end of this. He agreed, and he said that he understood, and he would answer all my questions.
When did you realize you're going to go fishing?
Oh, that's was a morning decision. It's either go to the morning, so play golf at the club or go fishing.
Okay.
Seemed too cold to go play golf at the club, so she told me what she was going to do for the day. And
okay, so she told you what she was going to do for the day?
Yeah.
And what was that?
She's going to finish cleaning up. Like I said, she's walked in the kitchen floor. Take the dog for a walk. And then she's going to the store to buy for Christmas morning breakfast tomorrow.
I mean, during the interview, I didn't really notice a lot. I mean, I'm just talking to him and he's answering my question. But then later when I sit back and I watch it, and I watch it, I mean, he is, before I get in the room, I mean, he's got his hands in his pockets. I mean, he's leaning back in the chair. I mean, it's comfortable. And I mean, I think at one point too, the phone rang, and I mean, he looked at it, he goes, oh, that's just so-and-so. And he didn't even answer it. And I'm thinking, okay, what if that was so-and-so saying, hey, Lacey's over at my house. But I mean, he knew she wasn't coming back. And, but I didn't know it when I was talking to him. I'm starting, after I'm watching it, then I'm getting those feelings.
Okay. So if you got to about 5 minutes to one, you get your boat in. How long do you think you stayed in the water?
Felt like an hour and a half or so.
Would you be willing for for me to take our gunshot residue off your hands?
Sure. No problem. Board exhaust show up as gunshot residue, or is it totally different?
What? Exhaust?
Yeah, from that outboard.
Well, you showered after you said so. I'm not thinking this is even going to be true, but no, it wouldn't. Do you have a map for that area, or
no?
Would you just wing it? So you just, when you got in your boat and took off, did you go very far? Or?
Well, I mean, probably a couple miles. I went north, found a like a little island kind of deal there. Island had a bunch of trash on it. I remember a big sign that said no landing. It looked like some broken piers around it. I just assumed it'd be a decent, you know, shallow area.
It was after that interview at 2 o'clock in the morning when I took Scott back to his house that I called John and I asked him to meet me in the morning, John, Detective John Buehler. I called him and said, this needs more than me, so can you meet me in the morning? And he agreed. There was some things that were unusual for me, for my, you know, just the, my gut feelings. I wasn't feeling like, oh, he did something to her yet, but I had unusual or gut feelings about things. I mean, like when I searched his truck, I opened the back door and it accidentally hit her Land Rover. And he was right jolly on the spot with a, hey, Al, and he called me Al right from the beginning. Hey, Al, I'll move my truck, or can I put this glove between the door and the Land Rover? And I said, hey, Scott, I'll be a little more careful. I'm not going to, you know, I won't do that again. But I mean, I'm thinking, okay, your wife's missing and you're focused right now on, I bumped the door into the truck. And so I just was, that was unusual. And then in the truck, I mean, in the back of the truck, I noticed there was some umbrellas all wrapped in a blue tarp. And I asked him, I said, what's this, Scott? And he says, oh, those are my outdoor umbrellas. I'm going to move them to the shop. And I'm in my head, I'm thinking, okay, why not just throw them in the truck, move them to the shop and put them in there. But he's got them all wrapped up in a blue tarp. That was kind of weird. And then there was another big tarp in the back of the truck, all just kind of bunched up back there. And I just noted those things. And when I searched the interior of the truck, he had told me it was his decision to go fishing that morning. But in the truck, I found a receipt from Big Five where on the 20th, he had purchased a 2-day fishing license and dated it the 23rd and 24th. And so I thought that didn't add up. And he told me that when he got home, he took all his clothes off and put them in the washing machine because they were wet. And the jacket he was wearing when he was fishing was in his truck and it wasn't wet. And so I'm just noting these things in my head and they're just, they're not, you know, not adding up the way I would expect them to be. And so I just kept noting those things and moved on. So we almost like hit a lull in the investigation right at the end of December, beginning of January. And we were in the office and we had a tip line up 24 hours a day. And I was standing behind one of our clerks, Bev, and she was typing and I was reading over her shoulder and she's typing, Scott Peterson's my boyfriend. You know, I met him on November 20th and he calls me every day. And I like, Bev, is that lady on the phone? And she said, yeah. And so I took the phone from her and it was a gal. She says her name was Amber Fry. And she said, she's dating Scott Peterson and that's her boyfriend. And I said, does he know you're calling? And she said, no. I said, well, don't tell him. I'm going to come to your house right now. And she said, okay. And so Detective Buehler and I let our sergeant and Detective Grogan know where we're going. And we drove straight to her house and met with her and her friend, Sean Sibley, that had introduced Scott to Amber. And from there, she told us a story that was pretty incredible.
What did she describe about him?
She said that her friend Sean introduced them right around November 20th. And Scott said he was not married. It was a blind date. And they met at a fertilizer conference. And after the conference, Scott asked Amber, hey, do you mind coming up to my room so I can clean up and change and go to dinner? And so she agreed and went up there. And sure enough, he had 12 dozen roses for her, some strawberries dipped in chocolate and some champagne. And he wowed her. And then they went to dinner, and that's their dating relationship started right then on November 20th. And he told her that he was not married, and she thought she found Mr. Right. I mean, he was very attentive to her and her daughter and buying them gifts. And during the interview, she's telling us, hey, and by the way, I have a bunch of pictures. They're down at the drugstore. I need to pick them up of us. Amber showed us. Took us to the drugstore, showed us these pictures of Scott and her on Christmas. As soon as we saw the photo of him at the Christmas party with Amber, and after interviewing Amber and she's telling us all these stories and gifts and cards and things, and they're all coming from Scott's shop. And when we get to the drugstore, right next door is a Radio Shack. And I said, well, if he calls you every day, do you mind? I'm going to go buy you a tape recorder, some tapes, and a wire. You plug it in your phone. And she said, okay. And so I bought it. And I'm plugging it in her phone for her. And I'm showing her, okay, when he calls, push these two buttons. And sure enough, the phone rings right while I'm holding it. And it's him. Because I could see the phone number. So I gave it to her and I said, Amber, you know, you're on, and don't tell him that we're here. And she talked to him like she was his girlfriend, you know, she did a great job. And after when we left, I left her with a whole bunch of tapes, and I just asked her to, every time he calls you, to tape it for us and we'd pick him up.
What were you hoping to get?
Well, we were hoping to get, I don't know, incriminating information, but at first they talk like boyfriend and girlfriend, even though his wife was missing. She claimed to not know about it. But what Amber didn't know was as soon as we did that, we also went and got a phone, put a phone tap. We tapped Scott's phone, his home, his two cell phones, because we wanted to confirm that Amber was being straight with us. She wasn't like conspiring behind our back with him. And she wasn't, and she never did. She taped all the conversations, and all the conversations she taped matched our phone tap conversations.
I'm finally calmed down from it, so.
I'm sorry, baby.
Wish I was there
for you.
I wish you were too.
You don't deserve any pain or any heartache or any arguments or anything.
So then why don't you tell me something good?
I'm going to tell you how wonderful you are. That's pretty easy to do. How thoughtful you are. How amazing. You know, I always call you, but I tell you you're special.
She even told us the first day that Scott had told her on December 9th that he lied to her originally when he said he wasn't married, and he broke down and he was sobbing, and she was consoling him, and he had said he lost his wife and this was going to be the first holiday without her. I mean, after hearing those things, that just her saying it wasn't enough. We needed to corroborate her. And that's what she was able to do on those phone calls. She got him to admit that he had told her that he lost his wife on December 9th.
You deserve so much better. There's no question, you deserve so much better.
Yeah, and I deserve to understand an explanation of why you told me you'd lost your wife and this was the first holidays you'd spend without her. That was December 9th you told me this, and now all of a sudden your wife's missing? Are you kidding me? Did you hear me?
I did. I don't know what to say.
I think an explanation would be a start.
I know you absolutely deserve an explanation.
Yes, I do. I do. And you want to protect me from the media? Why did you involve me in this? And how long were you looking for me, Scott?
I'm sorry?
How long were you looking for me?
Looking for you.
Isn't that what you told Sean? You were looking for me or someone like me?
I mean, the detectives are zeroing in. The family still doesn't know any of this. We're just zeroing in on Scott now. Other people did other things, but my job was to stay with Scott, clear him of any involvement in this. So, you know, one of the pieces of evidence or things that happened during this case that we had to deal with was there was a burglary across the street from Scott's house, and this occurred right around the same time as Lacey went missing. And so we had a group of detectives assigned to the burglary case, and we had I think there was a $500,000 reward out for information leading to Lacey's recovery. They were able to solve it. They figured out who did it. Well, they contacted them, and the Pierce, and I can't recall the second one's name, but they pretty much confessed to the burglary. They said, you know, one of these guys was riding his bike around the day after Christmas and found that, or Christmas Day or the day after, and he sees this house is empty, and he breaks in and sees a safe, so he leaves and goes and gets his friend that has a truck. And they go back to the house and they steal the safe and they steal all the property. Well, after they got caught, they turned all of that stuff in. They turned in property from other burglaries that they had done. They both took polygraphs. It was Christmas time. They both live with one lives with his mom and the other one lives with his mom in a shack in the backyard. But I mean, they had alibis. People know where they are on Christmas. I mean, all their alibis checked out. Their polygraphs were clean. They went to jail for the burglaries. We recovered all kinds of property, but nothing from Lacey. And so that was the most thoroughly investigated burglary that we've, you know, done in a long time. It was thorough. And they went to jail. They did not want to go to jail with anybody thinking they were involved in that case. That was one thing both of them made perfectly clear. They wanted their polygraph results released. They didn't want to be in the jail and have other inmates think they had kidnapped Lacey, a pregnant lady. Besides the burglary, then we had to deal with other people. We were getting calls of people on our tip line of people seeing a pregnant lady walking a dog. So we had to knock on a lot of doors. We interviewed a lot of people. We found two other pregnant ladies that were walking their dogs on Christmas. They were interviewed. Nobody could positively say they saw Lacey walking a dog. They could say they saw a pregnant lady, but nobody, you know, and if you don't, you want to be helpful. I mean, if there's a lady missing and you want to be helpful, nobody is being, they weren't like being sinister or nothing. They really saw a pregnant lady walking a dog. They called it in. But when you show them a photo lineup, or if you show them, do you know Lacey? Well, they didn't know her. Like if you knew a person walking, you'd recognize them and you'd say, yeah, okay, that's my neighbor walking her dog. But if you didn't know them, you'd just call in and say you saw a pregnant lady. So there was no credible Lacey sightings, none. So while we're still listening to the Amber and Scott talk and we're wiretapping Scott's phone, we get information from the Inquirer that they have the photo of Amber and Scott and they're going to publish it the next day. So that pushed us to have to break the news to Sharon and to Lee and Jackie. So two detectives flew down to San Diego to talk to Lee and Jackie. And then John Buehler and I called in Sharon and Ron to the office, and they didn't know why they were coming, but we were in a private room, and John just shared the photo and slid it across the table, and Sharon just broke down, and she just like, why did he have to kill her? And it was pretty sad compared to the way it went in San Diego. When they showed it to Lee, Lee looked at it and said, so what? I mean, you know, just because he's having an affair doesn't mean he killed, you know, Lacey. It was no big deal to the Peterson side of the family. I wrote a search warrant for Scott's DNA, for his hair, blood, saliva, and then fingerprints, palm prints, and pictures of his body. And we called him in and I said, we have a search warrant to get this stuff from you. So while he's in there, we show him a faxed copy of the photo. We ran it through a fax machine, so it was black and white. And when we showed it to him, we said, hey, we got a tip. And we showed him the photo, and he picked it up and he's looking at it and he goes, you don't think that's me, do you? And we said, well, we don't know. It's the tip we got. No, he said, that ain't me. And he gave it back.
Tell me how you think the murder went down.
So, you know, now that it's over, he's been convicted. I have my feelings on what happened. You got to remember, on the very first day on Christmas Eve, I photographed his hands, and he has a cut on his knuckle, on his hand, a fresh one. It's not even scabbed over yet, so it's pretty fresh. And there was blood in his truck, and so I believe that she sat on the end of her bed to like take her shoes off or put them on, because the bed is made now. He tells me they got up on Christmas Eve and they got out of bed and they ate cereal, watched TV, and then he went fishing and she went walking. Well, when he gets home, the bed's made. I think he just came up behind her. Either he bagged her with a bag over her head, or he just strangled her and she scratched him. And there's blood on the duvet, his blood. I think he wrapped her in a tarp and he drug her out to the truck, squishing that rug up against that door. And then he puts her in the back of the truck and he's seen by somebody, a neighbor, that says Merry Christmas to him. And he says Merry Christmas. And he's seen with a blue tarp. And so he's got to have a reason to have a blue tarp in the back of his truck. And so he wraps up these umbrellas and puts them in the back of his truck. I think he takes her to the shop, transfers her to the boat. He made more than one anchor. And we only found one in the boat. He admitted making one anchor, but there was no rope in the boat. No rope to tie it off if you're going to throw it over. So I believe he put her in the boat because we did find a pair of needle-nose pliers in the boat with her hair wrapped around them, not like on top of them, not sitting there, but wrapped around them. And so I'm thinking he and there was some chicken wire in his truck. I think he just put these anchors on her and got some hair on his pliers and threw her overboard.
And premeditated, you think?
So I believe it was premeditated because he predicted she was lost on December 9th. He searched his computer. He searched the tides of the San Francisco Bay on December 8th. He didn't search like, what are you fishing for? Or what are the sturgeon bite? He's looking at the tides on December 8th. He buys the boat on December 9th. Nobody in his family, friends, nobody knew he owned a boat on December 9th. He buys a fishing license on December 20th and dates it for the 23rd, 24th. So I believe it's planned. Now, I really believe he wasn't going to tell anybody he even went fishing. But by the grace of God, when he was backing his truck, the boat into the water, he hit the dock. And he told me when he hit the dock, he saw some maintenance men up there, and they were getting a pretty good laugh at how he was backing up this trailer. So I think that's what made him change his story from, because everybody knew he was going golfing, but from golfing to fishing. And even the very first neighbor he contacted, he said, "Hey, I've been golfing all day and I came home and Lacey's not here." Well, I think his original plan was to be golfing. And so I really believe it was premeditated. Every city had a boat. San Francisco, Marin County, Oakland, every city on the bay had a boat. We put a detective on every boat and with a dive team from those cities. And so I was on the Marin County boat, and they had sonar boats out there, and they would search for objects that looked like it could be a body. If they found one, they would pinpoint it, and then we would send a boat there and we would send divers down and to figure out what it was. One of the things they found something that looked like, you know, like this, like it could be a body. This is before she came up. And so it was late at night. The dive team couldn't go down in the dark, so they were going to go down the next morning. So big anticipation. All the news know. They're all waiting. Sharon, this is before Sharon knew about Amber. Sharon's still on Scott's side. And Scott decides he has to go to work that day. So he leaves. Well, we don't follow him, but we know where he's at by his phone. And everybody's waiting, holding their breath. The dive team goes down, comes up. It turns out it's just a big anchor, an old anchor. So Sharon calls Scott and leaves him a message, and basically saying, "Hey, honey, you know, we knew that wasn't Lacey. You know, it was just an anchor. No worries. We're going to find her." You know, just some sweet message from Sharon to Scott. Well, we got the wiretap on him so we could hear him. And so we can hear him pick up his messages. As soon as he starts dialing, we hear it. He dials puts his code in and hears Sharon's message. And then you hear him go, "Whew," just like that, like, "Whew."
"You have one unheard message. First message. Hi, Scott, this is Mom. It's about 12:45. Just wanted to know, I just got a call from Ron Cloward. He's at Marina, and it was a boat anchor. Of course, we knew it wasn't Lacey, but I just wanted you to know. I'm going to call your house in case you don't get this message first. Bye." Message erased.
Now, he's been radio silent all day. Well, now, all of a sudden, after he has that whew moment, meaning it wasn't her, they didn't find her yet. Now he's on the phone ordering pizza and, you know, X-rated movies from the hotel he's staying at. And then, so he can go from ordering a pizza and an X-rated movie to his sister calling him, and he answers, and now he's blubbering like a baby. Oh my God, he's just crying and blah, blah, blah. But the next phone call, he's fine again. I mean, it's just, the man was a piece of work. We're still zeroing in on Scott, and we're searching the bay. And you got to remember, Scott on 5 occasions drove from Modesto to the bay to watch, just to look at us. And we followed him a couple times. We tracked him with trackers a couple times. But I mean, he drives up there. There's police there. He could get out and say, "Hey, what's going on? How's it doing? You guys find anything?" But no, he just drives, looks 5 minutes at the most, and goes back. And so that we're still, you know, hoping something's going to happen, but we're in another one of those lulls. And when we get the word that a baby has been found in the Berkeley Marina, and the baby is found right around where Scott told me he was going, where he went fishing. And so that was a little spark I mean, it's just a baby. We don't know anything yet. But the next day when a body comes up wearing maternity clothes, doesn't have a head, doesn't have some limbs, we are fairly certain that's Lacey and Connor. The baby came out of her stomach. I mean, she's weighted down, I believe. She's weighted down. And the weakest links are the little bit of meat between your vertebrae and, you know, the meat in your elbows and arms. And that baby, just from the ebb and tide of the salt water, but the baby comes out. So that's something that you don't want to look at. And so we went to a judge. Detective Grogan wrote up a Ramey warrant for the arrest of Scott Peterson. And I called the Department of Justice. They have a surveillance team. And I asked them to find Scott in San Diego and just watch him. And we got the warrant. And, you know, it's the judge asked us, it's kind of a handshake deal with the judge. He signed $1 million warrant. But he said, can you not arrest him until the DNA comes back? And so we agreed, but we have a warrant and signed in hand. And so Scott's hard to find. I mean, I had a tracker on his car, but he sold it in San Diego. So we found him through the wiretap on his phone. So we found him. We set up surveillance on him. He knew it right away. He started driving like crazy. He was flipping off the people surveilling him. He was calling his brother. We could hear the phone call. He thinks they're private eyes or they're news people. He doesn't know they're cops. But he's telling his brother, I can't really come golfing with you today because I got these photographers following me. And if they see me on the golf course, that's not going to look good. But he's driving so bad that even the helicopter that we had up watching him lost him. He just would drive very fast, slam his brakes on the freeway and pull to the side. And, you know, four or five undercover cars would be going by him. He would go into these neighborhoods and do U-turns. And he just drove terrible. And it got to the point where it was dangerous. It was dangerous for the undercover officers. And we're thinking, here we are holding this $1 million warrant. And if one of those guys gets killed or a civilian gets killed by this driving, you know, is the judge going to back us up or are we going to be looking dirty? So we just made a decision, arrest them. And we called it into the undercover guys and just said, just arrest them, pull them over. And that's what they did. I was involved in a lot of homicides and a lot of jury trials. So I wasn't afraid of defense attorneys. I wasn't afraid to testify. I felt like I was pretty good at it, really. But when Garagos came on, the DAs would tell me, Al, he's got you. Garagos has you. He says he's got you. You're going down. I'm like, I don't know what he's talking about. I have no idea what he's talking about. And I'd see Garagos before the trial. I mean, you know, it's hard to be nice to somebody you're going to try to backstab. And so I'd be with John and Grogan and maybe the sergeant, and Garagos would be there with his investigator, and we'd be going to the evidence room, and Garagos would open the door. And everybody would get to walk in. When I'd get there, he'd close the door, I'd have to open it myself and go in. And it was just, it was just a thing with me and him. I don't know, but I didn't know what it was. And now I'm testifying and it's Garagos' turn. And we come to a point where I'm on the stand and then there's a sidebar and then they go in the judge's chambers and they come out and I could see the DAs and they have concerned looks on their faces. I'm like, uh-oh, something's coming. And so Garagos, what we do is we dictate our reports into a tape. Somebody types them for us, sends it back to us, and then we can correct them or change them or do whatever. And then sign it and turn in our reports. Well, he's got my tape. I've never heard this. Nobody's ever done it before, but my voice on a cassette tape, and it's reading something about, I can't tell you verbatim what it says, but what it basically says is, I spoke to so-and-so. I spoke to, you know, Mr. Jones, and he told me the lady that has a shop across from him told him that Lacey had come to her shop on Christmas Eve to use the bathroom. And so I put that in my, I taped it. I put it in my report. It's hearsay, but I put it in there. And so then after I dictated my tape, we go into the war room and we're all detectives talking and we're telling them. And I said, oh yeah, I talked to Mr. Jones, and he said the lady across from him told him that on Christmas Eve, Lacey came and used the bathroom or something like that. And Detective Holmes says, oh yeah, I interviewed her and she told me that Lacey came and used the bathroom. And so he wrote a whole report about it. And so when I got my report, I took it out. I took out that section because it's in Holmes's report. He interviewed the lady that actually had Lacey there. So now I'm in court on a Friday at 2:30 or 3 o'clock, my voice up there, and then he types out my report, and that sentence is missing. And he's like, who took that out of your report? And I said, I did. And now the whole room full of news reporters that I see on TV, it's a big deal. It's a huge deal. And now it's break time. He wants a break for the weekend. So this little bomb he dropped is going to just percolate over the weekend that I took out exculpatory evidence from my police report. I knew it was BS, but it looks bad, but it was not bad. And we're all under a gag order. Can't talk about it. Everybody's calling the police department about me and about me taking out exculpatory evidence. And finally, he's a good friend of mine. He told the reporter, hey, he took it out because it's in Detective Holmes's report. Well, that got reported over the weekend. And on Monday, when we came to court, oh my, Garagos, who usually walked in with a big smile, a Coke, and a different pair of sunglasses every day, stomped in there, peed off. And they went to the judge, and the gag order was violated. And man, the judge came out and ordered to have my chief of police there the next day. And actually a captain went. And the judge told him, if a gag order gets violated again, I'm going to put you in jail. And so it never got violated again. But the truth is, I took something out of my report that was, I could have never testified to it. I could never test, Mr. Jones couldn't testify to it. But it was a big deal. And that wasn't the only thing. I made mistakes. And Garagos found every one of them. And I felt bad. I mean, there was a point where I was like, make it stop. I mean, if I didn't cross a T, he found a reason to talk about it for an hour. Nothing to do with Scott. It's all about me. And so I was feeling pretty bad there for a while. But after, because I'd see Sharon and the family, I'd see him right there in the front row. And, you know, they're beating me up pretty bad, making me look like a terrible detective and all. And when the guilty verdicts came and I got to talk to her, and she said, you know, I never lost faith in you. And my department, after we went in, my chief and the command staff said, we knew, we never lost faith in you. That's the game they play. So.
His tactic was effective, but what I didn't like about it was what was happening in court wasn't being what was reported on TV. And it's devastating to come home or have, you know, one of your family members call you from out of state and think that you're going to get fired or you're going to get arrested or you're a terrible detective, when I knew I really didn't do anything wrong. I mean, it was all being spun wrong. I never got called a liar in court. I never was accused of being a perjurer in court.
But I'd come out home, they'll turn the TV on, and I'd be, some guy would be saying I'm a vile little man and committed perjury over and over and over again. And so that's devastating. But as for a defense, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years almost now, and that's their job, and he did his job.
We go to Scott and we say, we want to search the house again, like thoroughly search it. We want to search your computer and Lacey's computer. Maybe she had a stalker you don't know about. Maybe she had a boyfriend you don't know about. We want to search her phone records and your phone records for any kind of information. And he's shaking his head like, yeah, you know, that's a good idea. We should do that. And then we give him the form to all just sign right here. And we're going to do that. And he reads it and he puts it down. He goes, you don't expect me to sign that without a lawyer, do you? And this is on December 26th. We're just trying to find his wife. And now we got to get a lawyer or a search warrant. Well, we had the search warrant. We showed it to him. We said, well, sorry, Scott. I was expecting you to say that. And we have a search warrant anyway. So he looks at me. He's like, Al, where's the trust? And I'm like, yeah, Scott, where's the trust? I mean, you got to go. So then we could search. But that's why the Innocent Project thing doesn't even faze me. Go ahead and do DNA on the mattress in the van. Do all that. As Lacey was never in there. The baby didn't come out naturally because she still had her pants on. To think that then they're going to, these guys that ride bikes and don't even own a car, they're going to find a way to the Berkeley Marina and find a way to get in a boat. They're making a name for themselves. Maybe they're going to get some more business or something. But you know, one thing, Scott is, he is putting his family and Sharon's family through hell. And it's wrong. So I've been in law enforcement a little over 30 years, and I saw lots of bad things, but I saw good things too. But you know what? I talked about it. I'd come home every night. I call it story time. My whole family will tell you this. Even my kids. I told them, I talked about it. I got it out. I didn't hold it in like too many cops hold it in, and then it kind of eats at them and it burns them up. So I talked about it. And I, even when I became a supervisor, I would tell the young officers, don't hold it back. Don't tell your girlfriend, tell your wife about what you saw. Because if you don't tell your girlfriend or your wife, you're going to go to a bar and tell your partner. You're going to talk about it with your partner. And pretty soon you're going to be shacking up with your partner and you're going to be divorced. And so I had God and I had my family, and that's how I deal with it. A lot of times I can't even remember. I'm part of 33 homicides that I investigated, and I have to think about it to remember some of them because it didn't affect me.
Why do you think that case took off the way it did?
The Peterson case, I believe, took off because it was Christmas Eve. Lacey was a beautiful, pregnant girl, and she had friends and family that pushed this. They weren't going to let go, and they were calling news outlets, and they were putting up posters on day one, and they wouldn't, they kept it going, and then it just kind of snowballed and into what it became. Out of all the homicides I was involved in, I'd never been involved one. I've been involved in some, or as tragic as this, many, but none that had the media attention that this is getting. And even now, 20 plus years later, I'm sitting here talking about it still. Yeah, I think the trial went, I mean, I think the facts came out right on this jury trial. I think the jurors got it right. I'm sorry they took the death penalty off, but maybe I'm not. Now maybe he's in general population and doesn't got a single cell, but I think it went good. I'm not ashamed of anything I did in that trial or in that case. I didn't hide any evidence. I didn't fake any evidence. I mean, they can say what they want. I'm proud of Modesto PD and the work that we did and what we put into that. You know, the only thing I got one thing. You still rolling?
Rolling.
OK, Okay, so one thing that I found interesting or during the investigation was Scott was telling me how concerned he was because he couldn't get a hold of Lacey. He went fishing. He called her twice from the boat ramp. Then he called her again from the gas station. And he's concerned because he's not getting a hold of her. And so then he goes back to the shop, drops the boat off, goes home, and he finds his dog running around with a leash. That's pretty concerning to him too. And then he finds the door unlocked. He says that's really concerning to him. But he's really nervous. He's concerned. But what does he do? He goes in and only washes the clothes he's wearing. He takes the dirty stuff out of the washer. There's a hamper full of clothes, but he only washes his shirt and his pants, what he was wearing. And then he eats some pizza. Then he takes a shower, gets dressed. Then he calls Ron and Sharon and basically says, Lacey's missing. Do you know where she's at? I mean, so he's telling me he's real concerned, but his actions aren't showing he's concerned. His actions are showing, you know, something else. And so I think that concerned me. I'd see Ron around at restaurants and I'd talk to him. And Sharon, when I got promoted, I invited her and Ron to come to my promotion, and they came. And I used to send Sharon a Christmas card every year. And because I would write stuff in them, and I didn't just cite like Al Brocchini or detective. But after a while, I thought that I'm a bad memory. I mean, I'm sending her a Christmas card on Christmas, the day her daughter and grandchild are killed. I said, I stopped. I stopped. I didn't want me to make her think about that anymore. And so.
What are you up to in life?
Jesus. Well, I'm retired now, you know, and I volunteer. We cut wood and deliver it for free to poor people and widows and disabled people. So last year, my wife's involved, and there's about 10 to 12 of us. We do it 2 days a week. We delivered 335 cords of wood last year to people up here that can't afford heat and wood. So I do that, and I'm pretty involved in my church, and I got a lot of friends, and we love to go fishing, and that's what I do now. And I'll wait for you guys to call for the next interview.
And cut.